Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Continuing to read from the March edition of Rolling Stone magazine. In the random notes, the Q&A, the war and treaty. We want to be a balm for healing. The husband and wife vocal duo talk about embracing country music and rejecting division. In the past few years, the uplifting husband and wife vocal duo, The War and Treaty, started showing up everywhere. Since signing a major label record deal in 2022, Michael and Tanya Trotter, known for their blend of rootsy R&B and country gospel, have become mainstays at award shows, performed at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in November, and earned high-profile duetting slots with everyone from Zach Bryan to Ringo Starr. Before starting the band, Michael served in Iraq and began playing piano in one of Saddam Hussein's abandoned palaces. Tanya, meanwhile, came up as a 90s R&B singer whose solo career never quite took off. Both struggled with severe mental health issues, but have flourished in their partnership since meeting at a music festival, getting married, and forming War and Treaty. If their backstory feels like the stuff of Hollywood, that's because it is. A feature-length film based on their lives is in the works. Their new album, Plus One, represents the group's first full-fledged attempt at carving a space in mainstream country music. Tunes that reference country roads and chugging double shots of whiskey sit alongside the duo's trademark message of fostering hope and connection. We knew that Nashville had something to offer us, says Michael, but we also knew that we got something to offer Nashville. Here goes the interview. Question. You co-wrote with Miranda Lambert for this album. What was that like? Tanya? She's really a genius. I don't think people know the magnitude of her as a producer. Michael. I was trying to get something done on my end, and I called her for advice. I wanted to know what I should be expecting earlier on in our journey with Universal, our record label. And she's like, remember who you are. Put your foot down. Grab a pair. Be who you are and remember why they signed you. I was like, holy shit. Yes, Miranda. You got it. Question. Still, the majority of the songs are written exclusively by you two, which is rare in mainstream country. Michael? We wanted to make sure that Nashville knew that we weren't hands-off. We spent the time, we've been in the bars and the dives, and we spent our time doing some line dancing down at the Nashville Palace. We've eaten at Lambert's Broadway Honky Tonk, Casa Rosa's, we frequented the Old Opry, we frequented the Ryman, and gone to the museums. We're in the culture of Nashville and writing with these writers who helped create the soundtrack to the culture of Nashville was a dream come true to us. But we also realized that we had a lot to say that only we could say. Question. Some of your new songs feel like they could exist on country radio. Is that a specific goal? Tanya. If you're going to be in larger conversations, you have to try your hand at having something that a listener that listens to a Morgan Wallen or a Luke Combs or a Chris Stapleton can hear your music and say, I hear them coming right behind a Chris Stapleton on radio. That's not your end goal, but I think it is a goal. Question. Michael, a few years ago you said you didn't want the War and Treaty to be only be known as the Kumbaya Cats. Do you still feel that way? Michael, we are more hopeful in our human race than the normal guy or gal. I remember there was a period where we were trying to get people to say, look, we are one. Don't play to say, look, we are the one. Don't play into division. And there were people who were angry with me and Tanya about that. They were like, you're black. This is the moment where you should be pissed the fuck off. But what they don't realize is when I raised my hand to serve this country, I took off the cloak of black man and I put on the cloak of army, protecting my country, protecting all of us. So the first feeling I feel is hurt, not anger, when I see police brutality. Hurt, not anger, when I see racial disparity or pain. That don't make me a kumbaya guy. I have to be careful with my anger, because my anger is something different. Anger for me is fuel. It makes me look for an enemy. And when I find the enemy, I am trained to seek and destroy. It's more beneficial for me to follow my mentor when he stood in the courtyard in Alabama and he held the hands of my wife and my son. His name was John Lewis, and he said, "We are stronger together as brothers and sisters." So yes, this isn't going away anytime soon. I am not, and neither is my wife, Kumbaya people. This is our choice. We choose to point people to a better America and a better world. Question. What you just articulated speaks to the layers of expectations placed upon black performers in particular. Michael, me and Tanya, we were in a pivotal moment in history where we came out and supported the Democratic candidate, which is something I never really do because of my position as a veteran. This election, I felt like there was a calling to make a stand, and we did. A lot of people felt heard by that, and there were a lot of people who felt betrayed, like we weren't hearing them. The power of your celebrity is to stand in the middle of the road and hold your arms out and find a way to pull your brothers and your sisters together. Question. So you felt, after the fact, that endorsing Kamala Harris worked against the message the war and treaty stand for. Michael, I think it did work against it. Whether we came out for her or President Trump, what we learned is everybody is feeling like they aren't being heard. We want to be a bridge and a beacon and a balm for healing. There's a way to go through your career being a unifier rather than a divider. Question. You collaborated with all sorts of artists recently. Zach Bryan, Renee Rapp, Bon Jovi, Post Malone. Is introducing the Warren Treaty to new audiences a big part of your overall project? Tanya. In some of those moments, you don't even know why you're there. For me, this year is all about knowing why you're there and being deliberate in your presence. Don't do something just because you're asked to do it. There has to be some kind of vision. As you're building, you don't think about what you're putting the brick. You're just building. It's important to know even as you're still growing as a band. Even though this looks great and may be a great opportunity, we're going to say no here. This year, we've really grown into really saying no. Question. The Warren Treaty have been clear about their mission since day one. Inclusion and hope and bridge building, as Michael put it. Does that statement feel the same as when you first started, or has it evolved? Tanya? I've had to evolve because my neurological system cannot handle the level of hate and divisiveness. It's been a serious self-check for me to say, I'm going to pursue peace at all costs. I don't think you can, in a healthy environment, stay in that toxic environment. Some people thrive in that environment. They're looking for the fight. That's not who I am. You can put a message out there that you want hope and unity, and what happens is it's challenged because the other side says the only way to really know if you're a person of peace is to be challenged with hate. I've gotten to a point where I really still believe in this message, but I'm no longer going to put myself in an environment that consistently challenges my message. That's just me. Michael, I differ, of course. I feel like that message has gone stronger in me. My desire is stronger for us, even in just this country, to heal and to talk and to shake each other's hands. I don't give any credence to the ignorant things that don't serve. I pay attention to who is right in front of my face. I want that person to know that they are loved, that they are wanted, and that they are needed in my life. As long as I'm living like that, I'm following the mission and purpose that I've been in service to. To me, that's healing. And that ends the interview of Warren Treaty. In Rolling Stone's reviews section, Jason Isbell's acoustic guitar love stories. The Americana icon sets aside character studies for an intimate solo album about a new relationship. Jason Isbell has earned his reputation as one of America's greatest living songwriters by writing detail-rich tales about family schisms, working-class struggle, and Southern identity. But it is his gift for gut-punch love songs, like Cover Me Up and If We Were Vampires, that has cemented his legacy. That's the mode he's aiming for on his new Foxes in the Snow, on which the Alabama singer-songwriter benches his longtime backing band, the 400 Unit, in favor of just his plaintive voice and Martin acoustic guitar. Foxes in the Snow marks Isbell's first album since filing for divorce from his wife and bandmate Amanda Shires in 2023 and beginning a new relationship. While he's often prided himself on prioritizing the character studies in his songs, such as King of Oklahoma, Decoration Day, Isbell leans hard into autobiography on Foxes with jarring results. It's impossible to miss the allusions to Isbell's personal life over the 11 tracks, even if the first single released, the Cowboy Trail song Bury Me, now sounds like a misdirection. Repeatedly, Isbell practically shouts from the rooftops that he's newly in love. In the bluegrassy Ride to Roberts, he envisions his missus visiting him when everything's green, Tennessee at the end of June, and squiring her to downtown Nashville for a night at the legendary Honky Tonk. In the title track, Isbell goes full Elizabeth Barrett Browning, all but asking, "How do I love you?" He counts the ways by declaring, "Love for my love, her mouth, the way she turns the lights off in her house, her golden hair, her bite, and the way she disassembles me at night." A few lyrics on the album are so unguarded, so vulnerable, and so candid that they reinforce Isbell's songwriting bravery. "My own behavior was a shock to me," he sings in Eileen. Others, for the very same reasons, might make you cringe. In the gauzy Open and Close, he spies the doorman of a New York building fast asleep and ponders waking him. "He's always so sweet," he decides, "letting the right people in, the real friends." In the most ick lyric of Foxes in the Snow, he shares that he loves the carrot, "but I really like the stick." If the bulk of the tracks nod to Isbell's new romance, the devastating True Believer seems to take stock of his high-profile broken relationship. "All your girlfriends say I broke your fucking heart," he howls, connecting the dots with assorted lyrical clues, hearing God in the Ryman, the Nashville theater he played annually with Shires, comparing his stubbornness to the wine stain on your teeth. And yet, despite Fox's tendency to indulge Easter eggs that hardcore fans will parse, an easel, a Steely Dan reference among them, the album contains a pair of Jason Isbell masterpieces, Eileen and Gravel Weed. The former dissects the splintering of a union, putting the onus squarely on the narrator. "Eileen, you should have seen this coming sooner. Do I mean to be alone for all my days?" In the latter, he makes it clear that things have changed, not least among them his most well-known songs. Isbell apologizes to his girlfriend, his fans, himself, in the record's most bold line, "I'm sorry the love songs all mean different things today." But unlike those timeless compositions, this new batch, in all their near-diary intimacy, feel destined to remain stuck in their moment. Also in reviews, UK Drill's biggest new hitmaker, Central Cee, Can't Rush Greatness on the Columbia record label. In the mid-2000s, it was Skepta and Stormzy who seemed poised to carry British rap across the Atlantic as the sound of UK grime had its crossover moment in the States. However, their success proved to be more of a primer than a full-scale takeover. Inner West London's Central Cee, a Gen Z hitmaker whose reign over social feeds these past few years at this point feels uncontested. With his debut, Can't Rush Greatness, he delivers 17 tracks spanning a range of sounds and styles. On album opener No Introduction, Central Cee flexes the international scale of his appeal, making a quick melody of the countries he's famous in: Sweden, Norwegian, New Zealand, Australian, Arab, Armenian, even Asia, and Indonesian. You are inclined to believe him. He pairs easily with young Maiko on Gata, a breezy Latin trap banger that offers a comfortable space for Central Cee's bouncy drill flow. On the album's slower, more R&B-focused moments, you get a sense of a deeper range in CC's music. For all the jokes about his affinity for the phrase generational wealth, he's most compelling carving out melodic odes to girls he can't quite commit to. With a cadence reminiscent of Juice WRLD, Central Cee taps into a new sound on Truth in the Lies, with a sample of Ne-Yo's So Sick that has the makings of a major crossover hit. For all the album's strengths, it's worth noting how strategic the whole thing feels. To debut the record, he joined the ascendant Twitch streamer Plaque Boy Max, a true representative of his generation. Gen Z Love has the makings of an anthem for an era. Central Cee is as attentive to the music as the optics surrounding it, and his acumen for both is what makes his debut album a success and why his supremacy is likely just getting started. Rolling Stone Magazine Special Report, Apocalypse, Los Angeles. Surviving the firestorm. They built their lives in Los Angeles, then watched them go up in smoke. The sun rose over Los Angeles County at 6:59 in the morning on January 7, 2025, with many of its residents already on high alert. In Malibu, David Hertz had spent most of the night prowling around Xanabu, his aptly named 150-acre property nestled 4 miles above the Pacific Coast Highway. Hertz is a quintessential coast Southern Californian, a thick-haired 64-year-old surfer, an architect bent on building multi-million-dollar homes with recycled material. He was famous for designing and then living in Venice's Californication House, featured in the Showtime series of the same name that starred David Duchovny, and the 747 Wing House, a residence adjacent to his current property constructed out of airplane wings. His grandfather had moved out from New York in the 1930s and owned what became known as the Hertz Paramount Ranch in nearby Agoura Hills, where countless episodes of Gunsmoke and other westerns had been filmed. In the days before seatbelts and helmet laws, Hertz's father, Dr. Robert Hertz, performed facial reconstruction surgeries at UCLA's hospital. His dad would peel scorched visages back and then patiently reconstruct them. Hertz grew up skateboarding in Dogtown and then in the evening peeking at his dad's slides of faces horribly burned and mangled. In a way, it mirrored Hertz's experiences here in the Santa Monica Mountains with the eternal cycle of burning, destruction, and rebuilding. All of it was etched into his personal history. One of his earliest memories is of news report describing a forest fire that started on the Hertz Paramount Ranch. Despite that past, or maybe because of it, Hertz bought his current combustible property in 2017. The land had been owned by the artist Tony Duquette, who built a spectacular ersatz village called Sortaglum, Latin for fortune-telling, in the 1980s that featured spires and pagodas from the sets Duquette had designed for The King and I. Duquette wasn't known for his attention to fire safety. Other Duquette properties burned in San Francisco and Beverly Hills, and his landscaping made the roads to the property impassable to fire trucks. In 1993, the Green Meadow Fire quickly scorched 44,000 acres. While other nearby properties were saved, much of Duquette's place burned to the ground. In its last moments, each little house and pavilion lighted up in glory and was beautiful, Duquette said after the fire, and then they were gone. Hertz began restoring the remnants of Duquette's village that had survived Green Meadow. He built a lodge-like residence that looked up to Duquette's inspired spires. It didn't take long for the danger to come to his front door. In 2018, the Woolsey Fire surrounded Xanabu, leaving stallions at an adjacent ranch shrieking in terror. Power and communications failed. Hertz and his caretakers held off the flames as the fire licked the edge of his property. Eventually, some surfer friends arrived and tamped down embers and watered down Xanabu. Still, Hertz fled the land, driving his truck through the fire after 3 days of fighting the flames. Exhausted, he called his wife. It's all gone. But it wasn't. The wind changed, and Xanabu was spared. Hertz vowed to do better. He installed an elaborate sprinkler system and made the property water self-sufficient. With a creation called Sky Source that grabbed moisture out of the air and stored it in great tanks on the property. The invention won him an X Prize for innovation. He put a repeater on top of a nearby mountain to improve radio communication in case cellular service was knocked out. Hertz and friends professionalized their own fire defense abilities, forming 8 fire brigades that trained and worked with the L.A. County Fire Department. They were never intended to be frontline fighters, concentrating more on evacuation and mopping up fires that were already mostly out. One benefit was that they could bring what they learned to protect their own homes. Still, Hertz knew it might not be enough. Climate change had already moved in, causing schizophrenic changes in the weather. Los Angeles experienced a wet winters in 2022 and 2023 that left brush the height of corn stalks before harvest. A biblical drought came in 2024, and now the brush kindled, waiting for a spark. On the night of January 6th, the U.S. Forest Service issued extreme red flag warnings indicating imminent danger. Hertz walked through Xanabu in the dark, checking his sprinklers, his fire equipment, and his truck. The sun came up, and Hertz, in his yellow fire jacket and boots, listened to the radio. He knew the fire was coming, he just didn't know from where. So he waited. In Altadena, 77-year-old John Joyce greeted the high wind warning with excitement. He woke up around 8 that morning, put on his glasses, and ran his hands through his steel wool gray hair. Finally, Joyce reasoned, he could begin to repay the debt he owed Jeff Ricks, the owner of 2 Altadena houses, and a series of adjacent cottages Joyce managed in exchange for a place that he had called home since 1998. Managed is not exactly the right word, since Joyce also served as Muse Wise uncle to the 28 artists who lived in the 2 main houses, known as number 2656 and number 466, cottages and converted garages forming what the residents like to call John Joyce University, a name he hated because he believes in collective progress, not individuality. The residences were happy places, with a playhouse for kids on the porch. The front yard was often filled with stretched canvases of the paintings they were working on. Inside, art was everywhere, from abstract works to giant papier-mâché puppet heads. There were Bernie Sanders signs and a giant Thelonious Monk poster. You might wander into the living room and find Joyce sign at his work table while a performance artist slowly danced with a CPR dummy as the Ronettes' song, Be My Baby, played in the background. Much of Joyce's life had been tumultuous, marked by fleeing the Bay Area in the late 1960s after he was arrested by the FBI for not reporting to the draft board. He wandered the country, battling depression, until he landed in Altadena in the 1990s. Unincorporated and wild, the town on the edge of L.A. suited him. 2 decades ago, Joyce had fallen in love with Susie Stroll, a photographer and professor. But they were at different stages of life. She had free time and wanted to travel. He still had to work and was happy in his artist community. They broke up. In 2022, Stroll found Joyce's address and wrote him a letter. She said turning her back on him 16 years ago had been her biggest regret. They began seeing each other again in January 2024. Almost immediately, Stroll started having problems with her balance and speaking. In November, she was diagnosed with ALS and was moved into an assisted living facility in nearby Pasadena. Stroll's throat constricted, which made eating solid foods impossible. Joyce had a solution. Every day he would buy a pumpkin pie and then ride his Triumph motorcycle to see her. There he had mashed the pie and feed her tiny fragments. Her condition worsened, and she was transferred into hospice just a few blocks away from Joyce's home. She died on November 24th. Still grieving, Joyce felt guilty about the chores and projects he had ignored on Rick's properties. The high wind warning gave him a chance to catch up. There were things to tie down, and Rick's extensive automobile collection, including 2 Mercedes and a classic Ford Galaxy, had to be repositioned far from bending trees and other debris. I can be the hero, thought Joyce. Joyce got himself a cup of coffee in the shared kitchen. A writer was grumbling that Donald Trump's imminent return to the office had left him unmotivated. Joyce suggested he look at it a different way. The Marxists say all you have to do to destroy capitalism is let it naturally do itself in, said Joyce. Stating further, let history just go, and it will turn into total fraud, and it will turn into monopoly. It will self-destruct. We can do the same with Trump. Joyce and his friend agreed the world could use a little destruction. He went outside to start on his chores. The whipping debris drove him back inside. He put on a bike helmet for protection. A few minutes later, he returned and switched to his motorcycle helmet. He flipped the visor down and began moving the cars. A block away, Joyce's best friend, Molly Tierney, a photographer, cleaned up her home and left food out for her cat, Wallace, named after the California artist Wallace Berman. Tierney was from Minnesota, where she played on a hockey team before moving to Altadena and a spot in the number 2656 home. Friends joked that she still lived her life like she had a stick in her hand. Joyce knew the artist to be a young, wise soul, and after 4 years, he urged her to check out an abandoned house about 50 yards away. Tierney decided to squat on the property, a decision Joyce supported. She lived in a makeshift shack for the first 5 months without running water. Slowly, she began clearing 6 tons of debris out of the century-old home and quietly paid back taxes on the property. From mail deliveries, she realized the property was owned by a trust run by a man who had died without an heir. Tierney consulted a lawyer who told her to stay on the property but make no wages for at least 5 years. She went further and waited a decade. Tierney scored legal possession of the home during the pandemic. It still didn't feel quite real. The artist had not slept much the past 2 nights. The Santa Ana winds kept her awake. Overcaffeinated, she was stressed, but Joyce calmed her, telling her that windstorms and fire threats were part of life, but would never reach them a good mile below the Altadena foothills. Reassured, Tierney cleaned up her home and brought in some outside furniture. There was a friend to pick up at LAX Airport that night, and her day job working for the artist Paul McCartney was busy in a good way. The friend was an admirer of her art, and they had been corresponding for months. She dumped into her Ford Focus automobile, cleared some falling brush from the windshield, and headed to the McCarthy studio in nearby Lincoln Heights. Her friend's plane was due to arrive at 8 that evening. She didn't want to be late. A mile west, Donald Kinsey got ready for his job, teaching second graders at the Chandler School in nearby Pasadena, where the kids called him Mr. Donnie. Kinsey also ran the school's aftercare program, so his days could stretch 10 hours. His friends marveled at the 46-year-old's endless energy and patience. "Kids get me," Kinsey told them with a smile. "I just talk to them like little human beings, and it works." Kinsey was born and raised in Altadena. For nearly a century, the town had served as a haven for African Americans, while many other towns still had sundown laws and operated under the bullwhip of Jim Crow. Kinsey's family traced their California roots to his grandparents fleeing Oklahoma after the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. They found a home here, with jobs as mechanics and postal workers. Not that it was perfect. Both Kinsey's father and grandfather reported being followed home by county sheriff's officers throughout their lives. Kinsey was both in and out of the community as a kid. Attending public schools, he was careful not to wear baseball caps that might be mistaken for gang symbols, but he could ride his bike all over town. It was the urban-rural mix of Altadena that he loved the most. He shot baskets at nearby Farnsworth Park, watched the creative types planting flowers in abandoned bathtubs, and then cruised by the liquor store where cowboys from the neighborhood's horse farms would tie up their horses while they bought a six-pack. Kinsey swam and played soccer in the supposedly more affluent Pasadena, but Altadena was his home. He went to Morehouse College to study and loved the vibrant black culture of Atlanta, but something kept calling him back. "I had reluctantly left Los Angeles for Vancouver in September after 2 years in Santa Monica, where my boy could play basketball outside every day of the year. My family had preceded me, and before I left, I made the drive up to the Rio Inn, a Malibu fish shack I'd hit many 100 times over the past 2 decades. It had been about 100 days since my last meal at the Rio Inn. Since then, I had crisscrossed the country covering the presidential campaign. I watched Trump get elected and then traveled to London and Stockholm. On New Year's Eve in Iceland, I snapped a photo of my son in front of a massive Reykjavik bonfire. He beamed in front of the flames. Los Angeles received just a trace of rain in all that time." It is easy to shorthand Los Angeles as a dream factory, a place populated solely by movie stars, award shows, influencers, and surfers. It has become so prevalent that writers declaring the death of the California dream has become its own ecosystem. I have a folder on an old laptop collecting the best of the genre. What is forgotten is that there are 10 million people trying to live that dream, and it might not be the dream you suspect. An Armenian couple scraping together money for a bungalow in Glendale. A mom raising a son alone in Westwood after the suicide of his father. an East LA family afraid of ice moving in the shadows near MacArthur Park. These are not the types of dreams optioned by producers like Scott Rudin, but they are dreams all the same. The people I talked to after January's wildfires had dreams. In 24 hours, they ignited, flashed, and then vanished into the toxic darkness. New dreams can be conjured, but first the nightmares have to fade. Around 10:30 in the morning, Hertz heard on his police scanner that smoke had been spotted in the Pacific Palisades, a nearby Los Angeles neighborhood. The Palisades looked down on the Pacific Ocean from posh homes, a few that Hertz had designed. The smoke was quickly replaced by fire, and it sped rapidly, metastasizing from 5 to 50 acres in minutes. Hertz called his men, and they agreed to meet at Zuma Beach, about a 25-minute drive from Xanabu. They were not firefighters in the traditional sense. They had no big engines, just individual pickup trucks tricked out with hoses and water tanks. Eventually, the brigade commanders decided to send Hertz and his three-man crew 12 miles south to Duke's Restaurant, which firefighters were using as a staging area. They were then told to cruise through the nearby Las Flores and Big Rock neighborhoods above the Pacific Coast Highway and spread the news that the Palisades fire was growing with frightening speed. They found a surreal scene. Their radio cracked with news that the fire was heading their way like a caged beast unleashed. But they saw retirees riding bikes and moms pushing kids in strollers. The consensus was that the fire was still 10 miles away. They would wait and see what happened. It was around 4 in the afternoon when everything went to hell. There was a black swirl of smoke as Hertz hit the PCH, reducing visibility to near zero. Hertz had to tailgate the vehicle in front of him the 3 miles to the beach. They pulled into Topagana Beach parking lot. That's when they spotted a vast pyrocumulus cloud spinning down the cliffs behind the jetty villa. Private firefighters and staff protected the museum, but the fire tornado devoured everything else. Hertz and his firefighters started banging on the door of an RV parked on the PCH. The confused driver cracked the door. Hertz screamed at him, "You've got to move." Above, a Sikorsky helicopter tried to make a water drop on the raging flames, but it was no use. Wind whipped at more than 60 miles per hour, and the fire tornado, estimated to be between 50 and 100 feet wide, started shifting toward the Rio Inn, across the street from Topanga. Hertz and his men moved behind the restaurant, trying to wet the ground and tearing down a fence that would just provide more fuel to the fire. A few minutes later, one of the Rio Inn's windows blew out and the checkerboard tablecloths ignited. There were no hydrants nearby, so the brigade was left pumping out water from their meager supply. Hertz felt his face flush as the heat moved towards them. He spotted the fire advancing towards a propane tank and ordered his crew to retreat. They jumped into their truck and headed to a parking lot a quarter mile away from the fire and, crucially, on the other side of the Pacific Coast Highway. From there, they watched the Rio Inn explode and disintegrate. It had all taken less than 30 minutes. The radio barked out that the fire was now sweeping through the Palisades. The brigade dispatch reported that the flames were threatening the homes of one of its members, Tyler Hopman. Hertz consulted with his men and made a decision. They would try and save all the houses on Hopman's block. He pointed the truck through the flames and down the Pacific Coast Highway. He took a left onto Temescal Canyon Road and headed up the labyrinth of streets that make the area hard to navigate for newcomers. It wasn't quite sunset, but the sky was black, interrupted only by a blizzard of white, thousands of burning embers being swept through the streets. Hopman's house sat at the top of a ridge, a sharp, undeveloped drop nearby, with the village and Palisades Charter High in front of it. By the time the brigade arrived, the school was ablaze, and reports came in that flames were devouring an area called the Alphabet Streets. They climbed to the roofs in Hopman's neighborhood and looked out at a world that was ceasing to exist. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power had not turned off the power, and electric poles burst and shot sparks into the night. A member of the crew swore and stated what was now obvious. Fuck, holy fuck, this has got to be the worst fire in L.A. history. The brigade went to work. They hooked up their hoses to a hydrant and set up mobile pumps to draw water out of swimming pools. Only a few minutes later, Hertz had a horrifying realization. The fire was now moving up the hill behind the home. There was no fire department presence except for a lone emergency vehicle. "Can you help?" asked Hertz. But the petrified driver was just looking for a way out of the Palisades. That seemed prudent. By 6 in the evening, an hour after their arrival, Hertz and his small crew were surrounded on all sides by flames. "Hey, over there." A car was on fire. They put it out. "Behind the house." A crew member moved in and beat the flames back. Around 6:30 that evening, the men heard what sounded like a machine gun firing up the street. It was a neighbor's ammo stash catching fire. Water pressure was dropping, but it didn't really matter. "All the water pressure in the world can't save this," said Hertz, pulling off his mask to wipe a dark line of sweat. At that point, all the houses except Hopman's and a few nearby homes were on fire. Multi-million-dollar properties crackling like twigs in a summer campfire. Around 7:30 that night, Hertz realized the wind, smoke, and flames had left him disorientated. For a while, he didn't know exactly where he was. It was a horrifying and frightening feeling. He wondered if he'd have to pull out his fire shelter, a supposedly flame-resistant pup tent that firefighters climb into when a fire overruns them. He oriented himself and told his men that it was time to get the hell out. His truck was low on fuel, and water pressure was anemic. Besides, the wind had shifted. Miraculously, Hopman's house was out of danger. The men packed up and drove back down to the Pacific Coast Highway. He dropped off his men at Duke's restaurant and arrived home after 1 that morning. His hair and face were filthy with dirt and smoke. He gave his worried wife a hug. "We saved Tyler's house," Hertz told her. "I guess that's something." He then passed out on the couch. But he was wrong. The winds changed again. The Palisades ran out of water. He woke up at dawn. That's when he learned Tyler Hopman's house had burned to the ground. In the meantime, Molly Turney headed back to Altadena from McCarthy's studio in nearby Lincoln Heights in the early afternoon on the day of the fire. She was worried. News of the Palisades blaze was everywhere, and the wind was whipping up in a way that she had never seen before in her neighborhood. She texted John Joyce, who fought the wind as he made the 5-minute walk to her house. He urged her to head to LAX Airport. Reluctantly, Tierney agreed and got in her car. She didn't get far. A text from a friend told her a fire had been reported in Eaton Canyon, 4 miles from her place. She drove home and loaded up her car, just in case, with the deed to her house, her passport, and all the hard drives holding her photographs. At the last second, she headed back in for a beautiful pail with a naked woman on the side. That was a paintbrush holder her grandmother had made for her grandfather. It was now 7 that night, and she left for the airport. Usually, Tierney wouldn't mind being a little late, but tonight it was different. She had never met the man before. 2 hours later, they hugged in the arrivals terminal at LAX. Then Turney told her new friend something important. "I'm not sure I have a house anymore." Around the same time, Donald Kinsey arrived at his sister's place on Poppy Field Drive, a little more than a mile west of Tierney's house. His family owned several homes in the neighborhood, and he was currently living in his sister's house while she was working as a doctor in Bakersfield. He had heard about the Palisades fire and the high wind warnings, but he was ready to ride out the situation. The simple two-level house with a black iron fence lining a small yard was close to open forest, but the neighborhood had survived before. There had been only one previous evacuation order. "I'm 11 blocks from the mountains," Kinsey told worried friends. "The whole neighborhood would have to burn up before my house got hit." Kinsey spent the next few hours shuttling between his sister's and his parents' home on Alta Pine Drive, a 5-minute drive away. His parents spent several days a week in Bakersfield, hoping to take care of his niece. He brought in furniture and secured doors and windows. By midnight, he was exhausted. He texted his sister that everything was okay, but she would have to buy some new shingles. Kinsey watered the yard and driveway outside his sister's home. He then took a shower and got ready for bed. The fire still seemed distant, and he had to be at school in 8 hours. But something had made him set an alarm that would go off every 15 minutes. He woke up around 1:30 that morning, and the night glow had changed to a more intense, bright red. "It's still coming," thought Kinsey. For a moment, Kinsey considered getting some of his artwork out of the garage behind the house. He had been working on a giant acrylic work of Kobe Bryant before being swarmed by Boston Celtic defenders. But then there was a crackle that sounded like gunfire. A palm tree above the house had caught an ember. It burned quickly, shooting out flames that looked like tracer fire. A nearby house caught fire. Kinsey picked up a garden hose and started wetting his sister's property again. The torrent of water quickly became a trickle, and then nothing. He ran into the house and turned on a faucet. It was dry. Altadena had run out of water. Now was the time to get his art. He headed down a narrow path on the side of the house and towards his garage studio. The wind knocked him down, and the heat stopped him after a few steps. It was too late. Kinsey jumped into his truck. He headed to his parents' house and grabbed some of his father's artwork. Suddenly, he felt a burning feeling. His hair had been scorched by an ember chunk. He put it out, got into his truck, and raced out of Altadena towards Pasadena. He didn't stop until he hit the Rose Bowl parking lot, where he parked his truck next to other refugees. A few hours later, the sun tried to rise through a haze of fire and smoke. That's when Kinsey learned that both his sister's and his parents' homes were gone. More and more reports filtered in. Friends and relatives had lost their homes too. And that's when Kinsey realized his whole life, his history, his past, his future, no longer existed. Joyce didn't lie to Tierney. He thought everything was going to be fine, but he did know all the facts. The Eaton Canyon fire started at 6:15 that evening when sparks were seen in the hills about 3 miles from Joyce's location. A resident tried to put out the small flame and then watched it spread exponentially. In just minutes, embers were spotted a mile away from the initial spark. At 7:15 that evening, an attack helicopter with thousands of gallons of water was turned back by winds now gusting well over 80 miles per hour. Embers could now be seen on Santa Anita Avenue. The town was lit by an apocalyptic orange, tinted by the red lights of fire engines mobilizing through the hills. Around 8 that evening, Chris Pack, a resident responsible for a gorgeous vegetable garden on the number 2656 property, started banging on the cottages and converted garages, telling the occupants it was time to go. Susanna Mills, a painter and end-of-life doula, had left her place an hour earlier and taken her cat to her boyfriend's house in Silver Lake. She then returned to number 2656 to grab some belongings and keepsakes. The wind nearly ripped the door off her car. She fled back down Santa Anita Avenue, dodging downed trees and residents fleeing on foot. Terrified, she spied an old man trudging slowly away from the fire, a suitcase rolling behind him. As January 7th became January 8th, Joyce shuttled between the two houses. He wanted to save it all, his friend Jeff Rick's properties, but most important, the community where he had spent the happiest days of his life. The number 2656 house had a loft tower with giant glass windows that blew out in the early morning hours. Chaotically, the 77-year-old returned to his workshop at the other house, cut a giant piece of plywood, and struggled to carry it the 400 feet from 466 to number 2656 in winds now gusting over 80 miles per hour. Breathing through a respirator, Joyce sweated and groaned as he lugged the plywood up the stairs. He quickly realized the wind was too fierce. There was no way he could nail it over the opening. Then he got an idea. There was a thick old fire hose in the loft that Joyce had installed for Rick's. Its purpose was not to put out flames, but to provide a device that his buddy could rappel down, superhero style, in case of a house fire. Joyce returned the hose to its designed purpose. He hooked it up to the sink and ran it out the window. It worked. He began watering the grounds and returning back to number 2656, where he did the same with some garden hoses. Joyce ran between the properties for another 2 hours. Then in the Bible black pre-dawn, he climbed up into the loft and looked out at the fire on the hill. Something was different. The fire was now moving like a prowling carnivore, fainting down one street a few blocks away, and then changing its mind and slithering down a different avenue. A friend who was monitoring an LA fire app called him. She told him houses were ablaze just a few streets away. Joyce looked down at the gravel in the driveway. It was simultaneously blackening and smoldering. Everything he loved was burning away. He called Rick's and told them that it didn't look good. Rick's reminded him of a favorite antidote. Years ago, Rick's, a relentless consumer and eccentric investor, had bought the entire contents of a Vegas porn shop, thinking it might have vintage material worth saving. For years, Molly Tierney had busted Rick's balls about the investment, telling him that among all of his worldly goods, his collection of worthless porn was clearly his dearest possession. Joyce always laughed and egged her on. Now, as the world melted, Rick's told him to get the hell out of there. It's all replaceable, except for my porn. Joyce laughed through his respirator. He gave himself 2 minutes to pack up his truck. He grabbed a white shirt and a tie for Susie's funeral the following week, but in the darkness he grabbed the wrong box. He didn't have his tie. The truck was nearly loaded when he saw it, a river of embers flowing down Santa Anita Avenue right towards him. A house up the avenue exploded. He looked up, and the palm trees above number 466 were spinning with flames, fiery pinwheels spitting sparks at him. He closed the truck's door, did a U-turn, and sped away. 3 blocks down the road, he slammed on the brakes. Joyce had forgotten something, his teeth. He turned around and charged back up the hill. But in the 2 or 3 minutes since his initial departure, the fiery holocaust had somehow become even more deadly. Cars everywhere were ablaze, and a dome of embers arced above the avenue like festival lights strung above streets in Little Italy. For the first time, Joyce was filled with fear and dread. He was lost on a street he had lived on for nearly 3 decades. He thought for a moment that this is how it ends. But then the wind blew the flames clear. He could see smoke shooting out of Rick's loft. Reoriented, Joyce realized he was going the wrong way. Forgetting about the teeth, he dodged flaming wreckage for a mile half until he hit Woodbury Avenue. There he saw the terminally ill patients at the hospice where he had visited Susie just a few weeks ago being evacuated. A pile of abandoned stretchers and wheelchairs lined the ground. Joyce pointed his truck south, uncertain where to go. Eventually, he jumped on California Road 210 East and drove until the smoke cleared. He then pulled over, tore off his respirator, and gulped in the first breath of fresh air since the fire had started 12 hours earlier. For a moment, Joyce thought he had failed. He had not been able to protect Rick's homes or the countless pieces of art created by his friends. He had told Tierney everything was going to be fine, and that turned out to be untrue. But then he had a moment of clarity. Everything was gone, but as far as he could tell, everyone he loved was still alive, and that was something. Donald Kinsey's pastor was persistent. She wanted him to speak to her flock at Sunday services 5 days after the fire. Kinsey is a quiet and thoughtful man, not prone to self-promotion, and at first told her no. But then at the service, an 88-year-old woman named Faye spoke to the congregation. She had lost everything, but one thing remained, her faith in God. After that, Kinsey felt obligated to say something. He spoke of the rich history of artists and athletes in the Altadena Black community. There were no tears until he began talking about himself and his family. His mother's roots were deep in Altadena, but his father had been raised in Compton in the time of the Black Panthers and the Civil Rights Movement. Kinsey said he had always wished he had more of that kind of courage for himself. Now he did. "My pride died in the fire, so did my fear," he said through tears. "Now, anything that comes my way, I'm going to say, why not?" Reading from the Rolling Stone magazine's special report, Apocalypse, Los Angeles, will continue. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.